So quantum theory is an extraordinarily successful physical theory that underpins our understanding of everything ranging from the subatomic world to the structure and evolution of stars. But from the beginnings of its creation in the 1920s, it's been obviously of great interest because for a quite different reason, namely that it seems to undermine some of the fundamental tenets of the mechanical view of nature that underpin the development of physics for well over 250 years. So why is that? What exactly is the problem? What is lacking? How is it that we have something that's so extraordinarily successful and we could use it very well, and at the same time we say we don't really understand it, it's mysterious, it's obscure, what does that actually mean? I think a way to get a handle on that is to look at the situation that we have in classical physics, which we say that we do understand relatively well. So I think the situation that we have in classical physics is the following, that it has a sort of a tripartite structure. We have at the bottom a classical conception of reality, this mechanical view, this mathematical sort of conception of how the universe is put together. And when this is mathematized in a very natural way, it leads to the classical mechanical mathematical framework. So this classical conception, as we heard yesterday, is this majestic vision of the universe being this great mechanism where everything that exists is matter in motion on a fixed stage of space, moving in step in with a universal time according to deterministic and reversible universal laws. So it's this very majestic idea. And furthermore, not that's the ontological part of the statement, there's also a sort of a statement about how we relate to that. In principle, observers have this unfettered access to what's going on and can do so without disturbing what's going on. And the universe is so constituted, this is the promise, that finite observers who are necessarily restricted in their ability to probe reality, they have to probe it piece at a time, they nonetheless can aspire to, as it were, put all of these little pieces of knowledge together and aspire to a kind of global understanding of these laws of nature. So the mechanical conception makes also a great promise in a sense to us as finite beings that we can come to know this whole thing. And so when that's mathematized in a natural way, and obviously Newton and Galileo were the first to do this in a big way, this framework here is the notion that was described yesterday by Lee, the idea that we're talking about separation between states and evolution and laws being deterministic and reversible. And then we build specific theories like Newtonian mechanics, Maxwell's electromagnetism, thermodynamics, GR, SR, and so on within this basic framework. So you need to put specific extra input in here to get from here to here. And I think it's this tripartite structure that gives us the feeling that we understand classical physics, so we can span all the way from a conception all the way to specific theories that apply to specific physical domains. So in light of this, what is the situation with quantum physics? Here we have a mathematical framework, which is the von Neumann-Dirac quantum formalism. And certainly we have a way to go from here to here. We have a way to construct specific theories, be that non-relativistic quantum mechanics or quantum field theory or whatever. But what we don't have, after over 80 years, is still a conception of reality, a quantum conception of reality, which one would like. So this is what I think, essentially, is what we lack. And obviously, since quantum theory was formulated, a lot of effort has been made to try to get some understanding of what this might be. And I think there are two main sort of directions in which progress has been made. The first is to try to, I should have said really, this quantum framework is written in an abstract mathematical language that our intuition has a hard time to access. And that's rather a sort of a legacy of the process by which it was obtained, a relatively ad hoc modification of classical physics, sort of inspired by mathematical guesswork and inputting some new physical ideas. So this structure here is very difficult to directly comprehend. So one of the approaches has been to try to interpret this formalism, that is to say, take it as a given, and then to try to clothe it in some kind of ontological picture. And this has given rise to Copenhagen interpretation, Manuel's interpretation, de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, and many others. These have all been very important, very valuable, and guided the development of physics, development of the exploration of quantum physics in important ways. But one of the things we've learned from this is that it's possible to clothe the quantum formalism in many different ontological clothing. And they all seem to be okay. They all seem to sort of be consistent within themselves. It's very difficult to choose between them. And also those kind of interpretational efforts don't really cast light on the real origin of the mathematics of quantum theory. Why is quantum theory complex? Why does it use these unitary operators and Hermitian operators? We don't. None of the interpretations illuminate most of those questions. Another kind of approach that's been taken is to try to, as it were, draw out from this formalism general physical properties which we can get a handle on. So the idea is to give us a way to get a conceptual handle on what this mathematics is saying. And so we have things like the fact that measurements are probabilistic, the idea of complementarity developed by Niels Bohr, entanglement. These were known within a few years after the quantum formalism was created. Things like no cloning were discovered in the 1980s. Non-locality, contextuality much later. So once again here the idea is to extract out something from the quantum formalism that we can kind of get a conceptual grip on. And many more of these sort of properties have been discovered over the last 30 years, which seem to distinguish quantum reality, loosely speaking, from classical reality. A picture like this, though, raises the question of, well, how do I, in my mind, assemble all of these features into a coherent picture? If these are pieces of a jigsaw, how do I assemble them into a uniform whole? Put it another way, what's the big idea that lies behind all of these separate ideas? Presumably some of these are primary, more fundamental, some are secondary, but which? How do I know that? So again, a problem. This line of development leads to this problem that, well, how do we go from here to a conception of reality? And so these difficulties have led over the last 15, 20 years to a great deal of interest in finding another way to investigate this question about what quantum reality is like.
Sought for clarification, when you talk about classical conception of reality, what do you have in mind?
I have the mechanical conception of reality in mind.
So not about Newtonian absolute space and time,
well,
differential
okay.
mass, or
So we have to differentiate. That's why I differentiated in the picture. So obviously when Newton first postulated this idea of the mechanical universe, it had a whole bunch of different aspects to it. The idea of the abstract notions of state, which completely represents the physical state of a system, the fact that that's represented by a set of real numbers, the fact that that evolves according to deterministic and reversible laws in step with a universal time, and that there's a measurement process which allows complete access to that state. So that's sort of the abstract component. But then there's a more concrete component, which he then starts talking about absolute space, and mass, and inertia, and gravitation. Those are kind of the extra pieces. So in his work, these came all together, right? It's in a big package. And then over the course of the next 250 years, this became kind of differentiated. We realized that we can keep some of the stuff he said, the ideas of states and mappings of the state space. But we don't necessarily need this absolute stage of space, for example. We can do without that. We can make that more fluid, right? And we don't need this absolute time idea necessarily. We can do with a more flexible notion of what simultaneous means and what time means. So what I'm trying to say is that when you kind of look back retrospectively over the 250 years, you can sort of retrospectively sort of draw a picture like this and say, there's a kind of classical core. There's a core idea that underlies all of classical physics, and then the specific theories of classical physics are kind of specializations of that. So the new way that which a lot of people are pursuing, and there's more than one sort of strategy, but the strategy that a lot of people are pursuing is this idea of reconstruction of quantum theory. But the idea is very simple. Find a set of physical principles which you can put here in this diagram, and formalize them in a simple way, in a simple mathematical language, and then derive the quantum formalism from those physical principles. So this is the basic idea of reconstruction. And the idea is that once you've got that, then you'll be in a much better position to go downwards and try to, as it were, clothe these physical principles in some kind of ontological picture. So that's the idea. For example, going back to that picture I had where you have many different properties or features of quantum theory, if we could just pick out a couple of those and show that those are enough to derive formalism of quantum theory, then that really helps us when we're trying to, as it were, stretch our imagination around this diverse set of phenomena that we call quantum reality. It's much easier to focus on just a couple of those and then go downwards to here. So anyway, that's the hope. So what I'll do is to describe, outline really a derivation of Feynman's rules of quantum theory. So let me just talk about what they are and then I'll explain why that's a good idea. So here's a simple space-time diagram, and a particle moves from point A to point B. So this is the classical picture that one would have. And what Feynman's prescription is for kind of converting this into a quantum model is the following. Is to say, well, if you measured at A and then later on measured at B but didn't measure in the intervening time, you don't actually know it went along this particular trajectory. What you actually have to do is to consider all possible continuous trajectories that go from A to B. Right? I've just drawn obviously some of them. And the rule is that you assign an amplitude, a complex number, to each of those classical trajectories. And then you speak about the total amplitude to go from A to B as just being the sum of all of those amplitudes. This is the Feynman sum rule for amplitudes. And then he has a product rule, which is the following, that if you want to compute the total amplitude to go along this trajectory, what you can do is just take this and multiply it by this. So if this has amplitude U1, you can just multiply it by V1, which is the amplitude for this. And computationally, this is extremely important. It means you can break up any trajectory into lots of tiny, tiny pieces and then integrate across. And then finally, the third rule links together this sort of theoretical level of description, these amplitudes, with probabilities, those things that we actually learn about when we do experiments. And so the idea is the probability of detection at B, given that detection at A was found, is proportional to the amplitude Z to go from here to here mod squared. And the proportionality is just trivial, that's just fixed by normalization. So these are Feynman's rules. Now, Feynman's rules are very interesting because they're actually a subset of the full von Neumann-Dirac quantum formalism. But on the other hand, they're perfectly adequate for doing calculations. They're widely used in modern physics. And the interesting thing also is that you already see here many of the formal features that you see in quantum theory that we don't understand. The use of complex numbers, for example, the fact that you have amplitudes and probabilities, that's already there, and the idea that you extract probabilities by this kind of modulus square relationship. So when you translate this into the state picture, you already have most of the quantum formalism.
Causality is already there too.
Oh yeah, there's a lot here. I mean, when you convert this into the state picture, the von Neumann-Dirac state picture, you get the quantum mechanics for one system, finite dimensional. You know that transformations are linear, but you don't know they're unitary, and you don't know about how to represent measurements yet. But you get an awful lot. But the point is you can calculate with this, you can derive Schrödinger's equation from this, you can do a lot of stuff. Another really interesting reason to use this, actually, is that, again, from a strategic point of view, it's good to focus on a small subset that you know is very rich, and then kind of expand outwards. Philosophically, I like this because it gets away from the concept of state, which I have problems with, and goes to the idea of events and process connecting events, which I think is a much more fundamental idea.
So I'm just wondering, If you don't have a measure when you're adding these guys up, basically how you weight Z1, Z2, Z3, is this really telling us anything more than just classical theory? Because at the classical level, measure doesn't matter. But
using measure, you talk about measure of spaces.
Well, I mean, how you weight different classical trajectories.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the problem when you actually try to apply this to space-time trajectories. You need a measure of a space.
Yeah.
So you have issues there. I should have said actually that the way the form this whole thing can be expressed in a discrete setting, and that's really all I'd be considering, where you have measurements with finite number of possible outcomes, and where this is not an issue, the measure problem is not an issue.
Just really quick, are you going to view the amplitude of sign of the pass as primitive, or is the just the action come into your?
Okay, so when I derive, I'll derive these in their abstract form, leaving how you work out the amplitude for any particular process unspecified. So that is just as we find it in the quantum formalism itself, the abstract formalism. So it kind of leaves that unspecified, and then it's up to the specific theory of particles to specify that, how you work that amplitude out.
Well, I'll come back to that.
Okay. So just a very quick, just in case you've not seen this before, just a very quick idea of how this works. So you want to explain something like electron diffraction, like one of the big mysteries. How would you do it? Very easy with this Feynman picture. You just say, well, I have a source here that emits an electron. I have a detector here at the screen that measures the electron. And I know what happened in between. Classically, you will commit to the idea that the particle really went along this trajectory or this trajectory. Feynman would say, well, no, we consider both of these trajectories as an amplitude Z1 for this one, an amplitude Z2 for this one. The sum rule tells us that the total amplitude to go from A to B is Z1 plus Z2, and then the probability rule takes the mod square of that Z. And when you do the computation, you find that the probability of detection here, given that you found it here, is P1 plus P2, which is the classical prediction, right? Plus an interference term. So this is where the wave-like nature of particles comes from, viewed from Feynman's perspective. So this is quite nice. So now, actually, I'm going to show how you can derive this and these rules. So I'm going to set up, first of all, an experimental framework. The reason for this is that Feynman talks about kind of this is what you see classically, and he sort of has that as a background idea. I want to get away from that completely and just stick with events. Measurements as the primitive notion and outcomes of measurements. So the idea is that, you know, you have a box that generates systems, and when you feed it through a measurement device, you get a detection here, which is symbolized by 1, or a detection here, symbolized by 2. This is a Stern-Gerlach device. If you're not familiar with that, think of it. It has no bearing on what I'll actually say. It's just a black box which generates, when a system comes in, generates outcome 1 or 2. And there are such things. So you could just take that as a given. And so one of the things we can do, which will be very important, is to kind of merge those two detectors together. So if we get this outcome, which I'll symbolize in this way, that just means, well, a system passed through the device. Right? We don't know anything more than that. Classically, again, we would be inclined to say, well, really, the system went either to the top of the ring or the bottom of the ring, but we're going to refrain from such speculation. We'll just say, look, this is all that we see. Okay. So this is just like in a double-slit experiment. If we don't have detectors which tell us the particle went this way or this way, we'll refrain from saying anything. So the kind of setup that we'll be interested in making predictions about will be like this, where, you know, a system, let's say we get this outcome here, and this one here, and this one here, and so I'll symbolize this by a sequence of measurement outcomes like this. Or in the second run of the experiment, I might get 1 here, 2 here, and 1 here. So I'd be interested in kind of, I'll be measuring the probabilities of these things, so I'll be doing this experiment many times. And I could do a different kind of experiment where the ring in the middle is fused now. And a typical sequence of outcomes would be like this. And what I'd like to do is relate these sort of these three situations together, these three different sequences together, what the probabilities would be. Classically, we'd say, oh, that's easy. The probability of this is equal to the sum of the probabilities of the previous two. But we know that's not generally true. So and now I'm going to define two sort of formal ways of combining sequences together. So this reflects the idea that experiments that we do, some experiments we do should help us determine what happens in other experiments. So the idea that somehow there's some kind of compositionality, as the linguist would say, in these experiments. So imagine I've got two sequences A and B like this, so obtained in that first experiment. We can combine these in parallel, I will say, to generate sequence C, which I'll symbolize with this OR. You can read it as OR if you like. So parallel composition. And it follows straight away from this definition that it has this symmetry, that we can combine these two things together in either way and we get the same sequence. And this also has the property of associativity. So imagine I have three sequences like this and we combine them together. We have to do them two at a time. We can do them like this. That's A or B, it's off the edge. And we can generate this. Well, this would be the symbolic representation of this sequence. But you can also do it in a different way. You could also think of it as A in parallel with B or C, and then you would get this representation. So obviously they represent the same sequence, so that we can equate them, so you have associativity. The second way of combining sequences is that, you know, I do an experiment involving two measurements, and then I do another experiment involving two measurements, but the last one of the first experiment coincides with the first measurement of the second experiment. Sorry, that was a bit of a mouthful, but basically I can kind of concatenate experiments together, and so I can formalize this in the following way. That is associative. If I chain three of them together, I can do them in different orders. And finally, there's a relationship linking together these two operations, this series and parallel combination. And so if I take the sequence here, which is A in parallel with B, I can chain it together with C to generate this one here, which I symbolize like this, A or A in parallel with B, and then chained with C. But I could also think of this in a different way. I can think of it as A in sequence with C, and at the bottom, B in sequence with C. And I can put those in parallel, and that will generate something which looks different, but it's really the same. So this is distributivity. This is actually right distributivity, and there's a corresponding left distributivity relation. Okay, so this is a way of essentially composing processes that we probe experimentally, and this is the logic which underlies it. Now, Kevin has explained already how, shown quite clearly how you can go in a systematic way from a logic to a calculus. So can we do that? Can we go from this to Feynman's rules? So what we need, if we're going to do that, is some kind of representation. As Kevin has said, you need a real number, or you have to make a decision about what kind of representation you want. And that's not a mechanical thing. You have to make a choice. You need some input from somewhere. So the physical input essentially comes in here, to say that, so I'm sort of relying on this idea of complementarity formulated by Bohr, which I take essentially to be the idea that, in essence, to describe what's really going on in nature, you need twice as many degrees of freedom as you're able to access in a particular measurement. So he talked about, well, people talk about it in terms of wave-particle duality. You kind of, when you make an experiment, you do an experiment, you learn about one kind of aspect of the system at the expense of something else. So there's two-ness there. Okay, so I'm taking that to be a sort of a primitive idea. So what I'm going to do is simply postulate that we represent a sequence by a pair of real numbers, A1, A2, and that the probability of the sequence, which I'm defining right here, is extracted from it through some function P, which we have to determine. It's some well-behaved continuous function, which we have to determine. And the probability I define as the conditional probability of obtaining M2 and M3 conditional on M1. Right, so the idea is we prepare the system in this where, and then we say, what's the probability I'll see this and I'll see this?
Why would I not necessarily, I guess, sort of just intuition, why I would want this to be a conditional rather than a joint?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the thing is that it's to do with the idea that we're considering experiments where we have kind of a closure. So basically it's a Markov thing. So the preparation kind of makes the past history of the system irrelevant. So we have a nice kind of closed system where now the outcomes that we get later on only depend on the preparation, don't depend on what happened before, which we don't know in general. So we're kind of creating a little...
So what is an implicit assumption that you can actually do that?
Yeah, so I didn't talk about all the details, but the idea is that our measurements have this Markov property when you have atomic effects, in technical way of speaking. So to do this representation now is very straightforward. It's a mechanical process, so this is briefly how it goes. If these are represented by pairs A and B, this one, we say, is represented by this pair, where O plus is some binary operation to be determined. And likewise, when we do series combinations of sequences, C is given by A, O dot B, which is another operation that we need to determine. And when we do that, we go back to this picture of the logic. Now that generates over here these symmetries in the calculus. And as Kevin has shown so nicely in the talk before mine, these sorts of symmetries impose very strong constraints on what these operators can be, and we can solve them. And I'll just step you through it very quickly so it's not just like magic. So with real numbers, it's a bit easier. With pairs, you need a little bit more algebra, but basically it's the same idea. There's a theorem by Axel and Hossu that given these and some other minor mathematical conditions, there is just a pair-valued function f, which is invertible, such that this is true. What that means is that, just as Kevin said, we can take the space of all pairs, we can act on it with the function f, and in that space, this O plus operation is simply pairwise addition. It's simply pair addition. So what we can do, without loss of generality, is to go into this transformed space where A O plus B is simply addition like this. Okay, so that's the step one. Step two is that we use these distributivity conditions, and when we plug this into those, we find that A O dot B has this bilinear multiplicative form where gamma 1 through gamma 8 are constants to be determined. And finally, we use the associativity condition to constrain what these gammas can be. And we find that all solutions that are possible fall into one of five classes, which are either commutative or non-commutative. The first of these we recognize to be complex multiplication. So you can see where this complex numbers are arising for the first time. But there are two others as well, which are commutative. And as you can see, there are very slight variations on complex multiplication. It's about whether this term is present with a zero coefficient or a plus one coefficient. And then there are two non-commutative possibilities as well.
Just a quick question. We did pairs rather than, say, triples or anything else because...
Can I address that at the end? Please ask that at the end.
Yes.
Yeah. So right now it's a postulate that we're dealing with a pair, but it's a very interesting question to ask what happened. Do we have to do that? And what other things are possible? And I've just here shown that you can do a variable substitution, and this possibility ends up looking very nice, and it's just nice for the algebra. So we've used up all our symmetries now, and we still have, as it were, underdetermination. We still don't know what this A O dot B operator really is. It's one of five possibilities. But we said we want to use this calculus to predict probabilities, and probability theory imposes constraints of its own. So let's take a sequence like this, where this is assumed to be an atomic detector. So it's a detector which isn't a coarse graining of anything else. It's just by itself, and that's important. So we take this piece of sequence, and we represent it with pair A. We extract probability P of A from it. And then we can do the same thing for this piece. And then, of course, we can do the same thing for the whole sequence as a whole. So we can say the pair for the whole sequence is A, O dot B, and you can extract this probability from it. And what probability theory tells us in this particular case, when you use the product rule, is that these probabilities are related in a very simple way, that basically this probability is the product of these two probabilities. And now we can impose this as an additional constraint, and we can basically take all of these five possibilities, solve them for P, and we end up with these solutions here, where alpha and beta are constants we have to determine. And sorry, that went too fast, but the ones at the bottom, we can actually eliminate those because the pair-valued representation basically collapses to a scalar or a single real-valued representation. When you work it through, you find that those are just those are degenerate representations. So we're just left with these three now. And the argument I'll show here is one of two ways to kind of pare down all the way to complex multiplication. There's another way which is more formal. So we just use the idea that when you perform a measurement immediately afterwards, so you perform this measurement and immediately afterwards this one, you will get the same outcome with certainty. And that this repeatability property holds even if you put in the middle a measurement which has got one big detector. So this behaves, as it were, like the identity. So in this argument, I'm actually using some input from experiment. The one way of thinking about this intuitively is that if the measurement yields no information, no useful information that you didn't already know, then it needn't disturb the system or it needn't affect the system. So when you, I won't show you the detail of this, but when you apply this constraint, you actually restrict yourself purely to complex multiplication here, and you fix the value of alpha to be 2, so you end up with this relationship here. So this completes the derivation of Feynman's rules, and in the notation I've got, you end up with these three rules, the sum rule, the product rule, and the probability rule. So why complex numbers are so natural in quantum theory is evident here. It follows from those symmetries and those constraints. So just a quick overview of the argument very quickly. We've used symmetries in the logic of process, and then we've imposed constraints from probability theory, and then we finally used another argument here to get down here. So, as I said, the Feynman rules don't exhaust the content of a quantum formalism. You might ask, well, what about the rest? It can be completed. So, we've always been considering one system, but if you consider two systems, we can write down similar symmetry relationships about which must be satisfied and seek representations of those. When we do that, we find that we get basically what we know of as the tensor product rule from quantum theory. And then we want to introduce the concept of state, which can be done using no new ideas, just what we have already. And when we do that, we find immediately that measurements are represented by Hermitian operators. And we can ask about evolution of states. We find that we need some extra idea to get unitary evolution, interestingly enough. And there are a couple of possibilities so far of how you can do that. One is to say that it's not possible to instantaneously signal by performing a measurement on this system, to this system. So that there are different ways. But interestingly, you do need something more. And obviously then, if you really want to apply this to a physical system, you need something like the temporal evolution operator, which requires more ideas, more input. So just a summary of, you know, where do Feynman's rules of quantum theory come from? It's very simple. Feynman's rules are a pair-valued representation of a logic of process which is consistent with probability theory. So that, I think, encapsulates what's going on. And an immediate implication, and there are many implications, I'll just focus on one I think that's very interesting, is nowhere here have I talked explicitly about space and nearness in space and metrics of space, or dimensionality of space. It's appeared in the most minimal sense that I know that there are events that have happened, so presumably they're somehow distinguishable from one another. So they must have occurred at different spatial points, let's say. But the idea of space has hardly entered the derivation. And certainly, I haven't talked about matter or fields. I haven't talked about particles, mass, momentum, energy. Time is entered only in a minimal sense of temporal ordering. I need an idea of ordering. This happens, then that. I also haven't used the idea of nearness in time. So I don't have a metric over time. So there's an awful lot that's not here. What this shows, I think, is that the quantum formalism at its heart is a self-standing theoretical structure. It doesn't need to lean on classical notions to stand upright. And it's very, very solidly founded in essentially this idea of this logic, this process logic. And its status is comparable to the status of probability theory. So, very briefly, just mention sort of one interesting connection that you make when you do this, the two real number systems, or to the number systems in mathematics. You've got the algebras of real numbers, and it has these symmetries plus some more, but it has these symmetries. And what you can do is say, well, is it a representation of a logic? Is it a representation of something more fundamental? And you can do that, of course. You can abstract from this over here, where A, capital A, B, and C now are just abstract numbers. They're abstract mathematical entities. And they satisfy these same symmetries as here, obviously. And what we can then do is actually ask, can we generalize the real number system? This is something that, as a mathematician, you might want to do. To say, well, I'm tired of dealing with just single numbers. I want pairs of numbers, or tuples, or matrices, or something more general. Can I do that? And you could say, well, my desideratum is that these symmetries should be satisfied as far as possible, right? That's something that you might want. So what you can do is seek a general representation of this, where now the little a, b, and c are just abstract mathematical entities, which we haven't specified yet. And you can just check that it works. You can ask for a real valued representation of this. And then following everything that Kevin said, it follows from this associativity condition that this holds. All you need is continuity at a point, by the way, so the additional mathematical assumptions you need are minimal. And this is automatically satisfied, interestingly enough. You get that for free. And then you can either use this condition, or I've chosen to use these two. If you substitute this into these two, you find, without loss of generality, you get this. And in this case, you get associativity here for free. So in other words, you can kind of reconstruct the real number system from these symmetries. But of course now, we've abstracted from the real number system, you can ask for what about, you know, pair-valued representations. Well, then you see we're back exactly to the derivation of Feynman's rules. These are the very same symmetries that I've got in the process logic. And as you can see there, they're already there in the number systems in mathematics, which is a kind of striking thing that these two are connected together at such a deep level. So exactly the same mathematics applies. These three, this is just recapitulating what I've already said. And interestingly, notice that you have a whole bunch of possibilities here, so you need to impose some additional mathematical desiderata if you want to pick out complex multiplication. And you can do that by requiring every element has a multiplicative inverse. Every non-zero element has a multiplicative inverse. If you want to get rid of these, you can say, well, I don't like non-commutativity in my multiplication. And then you end up with these three. And strikingly, I didn't know this until after I did this work, but the mathematicians already knew about these 150 years ago. They called, I think, this dual numbers and these double numbers, confusingly enough. So they actually have names for these. And they've been independently rediscovered a dozen times, which is incredible. So there are like 10 different names of these things. It's very interesting.
Are you one of the dozen?
Okay, so we can see that there's this wonderful parallel between quantum theory and these number systems. So basically they share these common symmetries, which come from very different sources. And in this case, we needed this extra little piece to get down to the complex structure. And over in the mathematical domain, you don't have that kind of constraint. So you impose some other kind of constraint that seems natural to you, and you get complex structure. In other words, there's a sort of deep common core to both of these. So which gives a very deep answer to the question, why is quantum theory complex? It's because quantum theory shares this huge set of symmetries between, so there's a huge common ground here. These are the symmetries which, by and large, characterize complex numbers in mathematics.
But you said that the real is also for babies.
Yes, yes.
So why complex rather than real?
Right, right, yes. So can I talk about that?
Exactly.
Yeah, but so that's exactly the same question. So just finally now, so this is the picture we have. Our postulate box is filled with this, what we call the paired postulate. And this has this twin idea that measurement outcomes are probabilistic. We just take that as a given. Of course, the theory could say, no, they're actually, the probabilities are always 0 and 1. So we don't actually require them to be other than 0 or 1, but the formalism tells us it's possible. And we have this idea of complementarity, formalizes in this very precise way. So there's nothing vague or philosophical about it. We just have a pair of real numbers. So the question is, do I have anything to say about this? Well, so far, there's not. It's difficult. That's the next job, is to go downwards. What can we say about quantum conceptual reality? Quite a few things. I'll just say one thing, and then I'll close. Essentially, in the classical picture of measurement, the classical model of measurement, it's assumed that we have this very direct access to reality. Our measurement outcomes are deterministic, and we have complete accessibility of the degrees of freedom in the state of the system. So we have this complete unfettered access to what's there. And what it means, as was mentioned yesterday, is that every agent has this kind of God's eye view of reality. Every agent has the same God's eye view of reality. So there's actually no differentiation in the knowledge that they could have about reality in principle. In reality, they'll have different capacities because not everyone can afford an electron microscope. But in practice, in principle, they have the same access. Now, what we have in the quantum picture is that access is fundamentally limited. And it's limited in two ways. Outcomes are probabilistic, meaning when you make a measurement, you get a certain amount of information. You must perform many measurements. And you actually also must perform them on many different copies, many separately prepared copies of the system. And that's because when you make measurements, if they're to be repeatable, you end up disturbing the state radically every time in general. And also, because of complementarity, it means that when you make a given measurement on a system, you only see half of the degrees of freedom in the state of the system. More precisely, if it's in a pure state and you do a repeatable measurement, you only see half of the degrees of freedom in the state of the system. So there are two distinctive ways in which quantum theory kind of restricts what we can learn. And so we have this idea that in principle now, agents will have different knowledge about the state of the system. And that's because of their history. Their history matters. And there's always this gap between what an agent can know and what the state really is. So thank you for your attention. This is a reference which describes the work.
So we have 15 minutes of questions. Chris.
The language used in the last 2 minutes of your presentation indicates that you have an image of quantum reality, so this is the hard part, but it indicates that you have an image that a wave function represents incomplete knowledge of a hidden state, and the hidden state gets disturbed when measurements are made. You said almost precisely that. So what are your feelings on Bell inequality violations? Are you comfortable with the necessity of these hidden states being not locally attributable to systems, but
yes.
Are you working with the imagery of non-local hidden variables?
I'm not working with the idea of hidden variables. No.
What distinguishes? One thing to address is what distinguishes your view from a hidden variable view.
The normal hidden variable view, as I understand it, is the common view is that there are hidden variables which would determine, theoretically, what outcome you would get, but those are inaccessible, so you end up with a stochastic outcomes, right? So that's certainly not what I mean. I'm not saying there's an undeterministic underpinning of the probabilistic nature of outcomes. But let me go back to the thing you mentioned with the Bell inequality violation. I mean, one of the things, the implications that I draw from this, correctly or incorrectly, is that space as it were, the stage where everything happens isn't really fundamental at all, that the quantum formalism is really more primitive. And if you take that view, then you would, in general, not expect there to be anything fundamental about locality. So in general, the surprise is that so much of apparently our experience is local in its nature.
I wanted to come in precisely at that point. I'm just wondering whether you aren't actually wiping away something that you shouldn't. You talked about the detectors, and then you said you didn't want to say anything about it. You just wanted to know if something had happened there. Now, detectors, if I'm not mistaken, are always devices in a very, very special state. They're metastable states, they have to be, which is quite a complex thing. It's essentially a lattice of some form or other in a metastable state. So I'm just wondering whether that isn't a little bit, when you say all of this is quite independent of space and time, I'm just a little bit skeptical about
that.
Well,
that's why
I say
that's why there's a question mark against that. Let me try to deal with it in the following way. I'm taking what's known as the operational view to things, where we say that all that we know are, we do measurements and we get outcomes in certain sequences, and that's sort of the primitive input that we get when we do an experiment. So the advantage of this approach is that it gives you a firm bedrock on which to then build up something like quantum formalism. The disadvantage is that you then have to swallow these primitive notions of measurement and detectors and events, outcomes of those detectors. So that's obviously a problem. I'm not happy with it either, but it seems that operational view does force you that way. How I deal with that metaphysically is a different issue, and I think that's the bottom of the question of what conception of reality does this suggest. I'm certainly of the opinion, I have been for some time, that we need to embrace something more like an Aristotelian metaphysic, where there is a process of actualization that happens. And that isn't, we normally think of it as, well, when we do a measurement, an outcome is obtained. But I would view the idea that in nature, by itself, there are these processes of actualization that happen as in the normal course of things, what you would normally call sort of objective reduction, let's say, in literature. Mm. And in that case, there's these, so all the time there are these actualizations actually happening as part of the natural dynamics. So from that point of view, this idea of unitary evolution, where there's no actualization, and measurement, where there's an actualization, are kind of two polar idealizations about how we deal with nature. But actually, what's going on right now are both processes, and maybe something in between. And we're kind of describing it in this very simplistic, idealized way. So then, when you bring actualization into nature itself, then that obviously leads you in a completely different direction. So what I'm saying is that the operational way of thinking is a way to kind of get the formalism, but then you still can interpret it in a different way.
Steve, what's next?
Just maybe a comment and then I guess a question. You were talking about the extent to which you got quantum mechanics out, and you expressed, I think, some surprise that you need something more to get unitarity.
Right.
I mean, this doesn't seem surprising to me because you've eliminated, you don't have any dynamics, you're not using the actions in your path integral, those Zs are arbitrary. So for arbitrary dynamics, there's no particular reason why you would expect to have energy conservation, unitarity, all these things that have to do traditionally with dynamics. And so what you end up with is a generalized framework, which I suppose if you stick in an appropriate action, you derive your Z's from a particular kind of action, then you get much of the rest of what you expect in quantum mechanics.
But you actually need very, very little. I mean, for example, the axiom of no signaling is enough to get unitarity from this approach. So I just need to postulate that if you and I share an entangled state, I can't make a measurement on my side, get an outcome, and you can thereby figure out that I've signaled to you that I've done
this
something.
This is for non-relativistic.
No, this is the, in this. So if you take the Feynman rules and you translate them, if you introduce the concept of state, you get the finite dimensional von Neumann-Dirac formalism with evolution represented by linear transformations. So you know that basically you end up with matrices which you know are linear and...
Okay, just before you go, you said you didn't have any space.
the general form. So I don't know what.
You don't need space to get unitarity.
No, but you had a no signal. That's a, typically what you mean by no signal.
You need the notion of independent systems. You don't need space. You need the idea that, you know, I have a system and you have a system, and, you know, the idea that they're statistically independent. I mean, you don't need the notion of space necessarily. That could be a derived secondary notion. We could say we're far apart if. We could turn the logic upside down.
Right. Yeah.
I can see why you want to focus on quantum mechanics, but I was just thinking this might be an interesting way to map out alternatives if something goes wrong. Right. So you've got this kind of morphism perspective on logical principles and numbers, right? And you could say, well, you actually can get an ordered diagram of ways in which symmetries can get knocked out by nature, and you get new theories, right? So I guess that might be, of course, in logic, when you knock out one axiom, that doesn't mean you just knock it out, right? You could put in weaker ones,
right?
That's not the sort that have been looked at in algebraic logics, right, non-standard algebraic logics, and get different kinds of theories for those, right? I mean, it's that kind of a, you can sort of map out the future
right.
of physics if things go wrong.
Yeah, but that's, in a sense, you know, that one of the big motivations to do this kind of thing is precisely that, to help guide the future development, and to be able to say, you know, just when we look at, when we say quantum theory, it means a lot of stuff. It means that there's the von Neumann direct formalism, which has lots of different pieces, and then there's the commutation relationships and so on. But that's an undifferentiated blob, and it would be nice to sort of separate it out and say, look, there's some part of this which is really, really basic, and there's some part of it which seems less basic, and then all the way up to a certain point where you say, actually, here I'm putting in this notion of energy, which comes from classical physics, to get temporal evolution or something like that, and maybe I'm not happy with them. So exactly, yeah, that's exactly right. And this bears on the discussion yesterday that, you know, could the laws of physics be mutable, right? When you do this kind of reconstruction, you can stand back and say, ah, well, this logic of process doesn't look very mutable. Representation doesn't look very mutable because 2 can either be 1 or 3 or 4, but it can't continuously change. So it doesn't look like there's that much flexibility there. So at what point in the chain could I have some continuous parameters that could change gracefully without breaking the structure? It's not that obvious to me. I mean, having looked at it briefly, I hadn't really thought about this before yesterday, actually, about the mutability idea. But it only seems that H bar is the, you know, the only thing that, which comes in way at the end. It comes in through the temporal evolution law, which is the last thing on the slide that I had. It doesn't seem that you can gracefully change that structure at the beginning. But what you said, I hadn't thought about sort of weakening those axioms for the logic of process.
Like distributivity for some reason.
Yeah. But the question is, could you do it? And maybe we should talk about that, about how it could be done.
Yeah, they talk about the representation from the real number and a pair of real numbers, whether there is other representation in particular discrete number.
So let me talk about that. So I put that off during the talk. So the question is, can you do a real number representation? The answer is yes. That everything works, the derivation works.
But I mean, I'm asking whether there's other discrete representation, like some other field or something.
So you're taking a mathematical object that's not even an n tuple, you mean?
Not continuous one, a discrete one.
Like a rational number pair.
For example, even more discrete, or even finite set.
Right.
Infinite set, whether there's a finite set representation.
Well, I mean, I just started to look into this. The mathematics gets quite hairy once you don't have continuity. So basically, these associativity, these function equations, you turn out that if you have a continuity at a point and you're dealing with real numbers, everything is nice. As soon as you lose that, you're not dealing with real numbers, you go to rational numbers. Then you need additional properties that replace continuity, like cancellativity. So you need additional.
Since you only have this associativity distributivity,
right.
So there's no continuity required on the surface.
Yeah, I have a lot of hope that you can do this without assuming real numbers. And my hope is based on the fact that Axel, Janos Axel, who's this mathematician who's behind these theorems that we're quoting, Kevin and I, he has indeed shown the associativity equation can be solved for rational numbers, but you need something else, some cancellativity property or some monotonicity property. So you need extra things. And from a physics point of view, the question is what would justify that, those mathematical assumptions. I'm happier to deal with real numbers and continuity because I guess I'm more familiar with it. But yes, these are absolutely great questions. And the question then is, can we stretch the mathematics so we can go beyond real numbers?
This may be a naive comment slash question, but you know, if you look at the history of how quantum mechanics came about, it was really from all the experiments that came up and challenged people to kind of think in different ways, right? And so all sorts of rules came up and they came up with formalism. But I may not have understood very well everything you said, but it seems to me that basically you can invent a set of rules, right, that is compatible with what people have found, you know, in other ways in quantum mechanics. So you can actually perhaps play this game in a more general way and say, if I change my rules, what kind of other implementations of natural systems can I come up with? And maybe that way you can think of why is it nature choosing this particular set of rules and not other sets of rules?
But are you thinking about the logic being changed?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing. Let me
say that differently. If there were no experiments,
right,
in principle, people could have invented quantum mechanics from just hitting on the right set of rules. That's what I mean.
What I suppose I'm saying is that I can't see any reason why this could have been done 150 years ago.
That's what I mean.
I mean, it really, the logic of process is just so obvious. I mean, it's actually just restraining yourself from making metaphysical sort of speculations about what's going on when you haven't measured. Just obeying that dictum gives you the logic. And when you do, the key point is why would you choose a pair value representation?
Right. But that begs the question, which I don't know if there is an answer to it or not, which is, okay, so why is nature choosing this particular set and not another?
You mean like why this particular logic?
Logic, right.
But I don't see that there's any... I don't think nature is actually choosing that. That's just a language for describing what we see.
Well, that's saying the same thing afterwards.
Is it?
Well, why is it? I think you're asking, why is nature choosing a pair value representation?
I think a different question. I think I've been asked the question about where does the logic of process come from? Am I right?
There's
two questions. Yeah. My view is that logic, I can't see that it admits any variation, and I think that's an absolutely minimal statement. It's a bit like the Boolean logic of propositions. It has the same status. It's very basic. I can't see any way of changing that. But maybe I'm wrong, and it'll be great to know if there is a way of changing it nicely. The question about the pair value representation, let me finally address that properly. If you take a real number, the same derivation goes through, and what you get is quantum mechanics restricted to real numbers. So the derivation goes through, and the derivation I've got right now can't say why that's wrong, why that's not true.
Or triples.
Okay, so let me go to that. So in the case of real numbers, real and complex quantum mechanics, it seems like we need some additional idea to say why complex quantum mechanics holds. I'm unsettled on what that further idea might be. Yeah, you get the equivalent of unitarity. Basically, you get orthogonal transformations, sort of unitaries. So you get unitaries restricted to the real numbers.
So we have time for one last question.
Just finish this, actually.
The triples.
The real versus complex quantum mechanics. One idea is that there's this notion of what's called local tomography. So the idea is that imagine I have a bipartite state, or two different bipartite states that I give to you. Can you and a friend, by making measurements on each separate system, figure out that these are different states? Can you distinguish between them? Can you distinguish between all possible bipartite states by these local operations? So if you can, that's called local tomography. Now, this comes back to this promise that's made in the mechanical conceptual reality. Is reality so constituted that it's nice to us, that we can figure out what's going on by doing local operations alone. If we can, that's the property of local tomography, that singles out complex quantum mechanics. So that eliminates real quantum mechanics.
And
so that's
triples.
Okay, so now the triples. Okay, so the natural question is why not triples? Why not arbitrary n tuples? Simple answer, I don't know for sure. But the mathematicians have very powerful theorems which say that if you try to create number systems satisfying the symmetries I described, then in fact you have very few possibilities. So there's a general theorem that says that if you not you need more than just the symmetries I described, but a bunch of conditions, you have real complex quaternion and octonions. So 1, 2, 4, and 8 are the only possibilities. And you find that the quaternion case has non-commutative multiplication, which is ruled out at some point in the derivation. And the octonions are non-associative in multiplication. That's certainly ruled out by the logic of calculus straight away. So if, now this is a big if, it's possible to somehow take what the mathematicians have done and translate it over into this framework, then I hope, we can eliminate all but real and complex, and we'll be forced by local tomography to complex. That's the program, that's the hope. But the mathematicians use language and assumptions that aren't natural to me at the moment. So it's a question of, can we translate those ideas?
Will be a very quick question?
Yeah, it's kind of a marginal comment, but maybe I think it's worth making because people miss the point. I mean, in some sense, the actual classical picture almost all classical physicists is of an ontology of continuous flexible substances. Now, many physicists, or at least foundational questions, act like the transition from discrete numbers of degrees of freedom to infinite number to get a genuine continuum is fairly trivial or straightforward. Now, there's no worker in rigorous continuum mechanics believes that. And thinks that all those sorts of just change of summation into an integral are just horrible moves to make. And when you do it properly in a continuum mechanics framework, then it's often the case that many of your local assumptions break down. So we'll have over volumes well-defined momentum and so forth, but they do not always induce those properties on the local level. And so there's always the possibility that we need to think about the formulation of quantum mechanics more from that sort of a global perspective, because we have, you know, again, fields and things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one tack to take is that, well, just a sort of historical comment, that I think until the sort of advent of quantum information computing, there was a great emphasis put on the infinite dimensional quantum formalism, and actually saying that that's the thing that we should really try to understand. But I think the quantum information computing shows that so much comes out of looking at just finite dimensional systems. So people, so the reconstructive efforts, most of them trying to say, well, no, actually the finite dimensional formalism is enough. But let me get, there are a few other points. Secondly, if you're taking this operational point of view, the idea of an infinite number of possible outcomes, a non-denumerably infinite number of outcomes, is a very strange one, because operationally we can't ever get that. We only have a finite number of detectors. So that sort of operational point of view kind of pushes you to the finite dimensional formalism sort of very naturally. And then finally, I suppose with my own view, is that the finite dimensional formalism is really the formalism. The infinite dimensional case is really an approximation, a convenient way of calculating with very large numbers of detectors, but finitely many of them. And certainly then, so clues from black hole thermodynamics and so on also seem to be pointing in the direction that this idea of a continuum of space is a kind of fiction, and in fact that there are actually finitely many degrees of freedom which you actually need.
But you want to be a little careful about saying, oh, it's clear what the classical point of view is and what it's set, these postulates about local observation, how that probably not so clear.
Okay, so we'll have to cut it there. So we've got only a couple of minutes for any kind of emergency break, to use a euphemism. not enough time for a coffee break. And so then we'll try to reconvene in just a couple of minutes for our last talk of the morning.